He was strong, tight as a marionette. But when I spoke, a little of the tension left the arm under my hand, and I saw that he had closed his eyes. "I'm sorry, Auntie," he whispered. Wordless, I patted his arm. The bee flew off, and I wished passionately that I could exchange places with it. It would be so wonderful simply to be about the business of gathering single-minded in the sun. Another bee lighted on Ian's collar, and he brushed it absently away. "Well, so," he said, taking a deep breath and turning his head to look at me. "What must I do, Auntie?" His eyes were dark with misery and worry, and something very like fear, I thought. "Do," I said, sounding as blank as I felt. "Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ, Ian!" I hadn't meant to make him smile, and he didn't. But he did seem to relax very slightly. "Aye, I've done it already," he said, very rueful. "But it's done, Auntie. How can I mend it?" I rubbed my brow, trying to think. Rollo had brought back his ball, but seeing that Ian was in no mood to play, dropped it by his feet and leaned against his leg, panting. "Morva," I said finally. "Did she tell you? Before, I mean." "You think I scorned her, and that's what made her accuse Uncle Jamie?" He gave me a wry look, absently scratching Rollo's ruff. "Well, I wouldn't have blamed you if you did, Auntie, but no. She said not a word to me about the matter. If she had, I should have married her at once." The hurdle of confession overcome, he was talking more easily now. "You didn't think of marrying her first," I said, with perhaps a slight tinge of acerbity. No, he said, very sheepish. "It wasn't precisely a matter of... Well, I wasn't thinking at all, Auntie. I was drunk. The first time, anyway," he added as an afterthought. "The first? How many..." "No, don't tell me. I don't want to know the gory details." I shut him up with a brusque gesture and sat up straight, struck by a thought. "Bobby Higgins, was that..." He nodded, lowering his lashes so I couldn't see his eyes. The blood had come up under his tan. "Aye, that was why... I mean, I didn't have really wished to marry her to begin with. But still, I would have asked after we... But I put it off a bit and..." He scrubbed a hand across his face, helpless. "Well, I didn't want her to wife, but I couldn't keep from wanting her nonetheless. And I kent well enough how awful it must seem. But I've got to tell the truth, Auntie. And that's it." He took a gulp of air and continued. "I'd wait for her in the woods when she came to gather. She'd not speak when she saw me, only smile and raise her skirts a bit, then turn quick and run and... Good I should be after her like a dog after a bitch in heat," he said bitterly. "But then one day I came late, and she wasn't there where we usually met. But I heard her laughing far off, and when I went to see..." He twisted his hands hard enough to dislocate a finger, grimacing, and Rollo whined softly. "Let us just see that yon bairn might well be Bobby Higgins, too," he said, biting off the words. I felt suddenly exhausted, as I had when recovering from my illness, as though it was too much effort even to breathe. I leaned back against the palisades, feeling the cool, papery rustle of grape leaves against my neck, fanning softly over my heated cheeks. Ian bent forward, head in his hands, the dappled green shadows playing over him. "What shall I do?" he asked at last, voice muffled. He sounded as tired as I felt. "I dinna mind saying that the child might be mine. But would it help, do you think?" "No," I said bleakly. "It wouldn't. Public opinion wouldn't be changed in the slightest. Everyone would simply assume that Ian was lying for his uncle's sake. Even if he were to marry the girl, it wouldn't." A thought struck me, and I pulled myself upright again. "You said you didn't want to marry her, even before you knew about Bobby. Why?" I asked curiously. He lifted his head from his hand with a helpless gesture. "I didn't ken how to say it. She was, well, she was bonny enough, aye, and a proper spirit to her as well. But she... I dinna ken, auntie. It was only that I always had the feeling, lying with her, that I dare not fall asleep. I stared at him.
Well, that would be off-putting, I imagine.
He had dismissed that, though, and was frowning, digging the heel of his moccasin into the soil.
"There's no means of telling which of two men is father to bairn, is there?" he asked abruptly.
"Only, if it's mine, I should want it. I would wed her for the child's sake, no matter what else. If it's mine."
Bree had told me the bare bones of his history. I knew about his Mohawk wife, Emily, and the death of his daughter, and I felt the small presence of my own first child, Faith, stillborn, but always with me.
"Oh, Ian," I said softly and touched his hair, "you might be able to tell by the way the child looked, but probably not,
or not right away."
He nodded and sighed.
After a moment, he said, "If I say it's mine, and I wed her, folk might still talk, but after a time..."
His voice died away.
True, talk might eventually die down, but there would still be those who thought Jamie responsible, others who would call Malva a whore, a liar, or both, which she bloody well was, I reminded myself, but not a nice thing to hear about one's wife. And what might Ian's life be like, married under such circumstances, to a woman he couldn't trust, and, I thought, didn't especially like?
"Well," I said, rising to my feet and stretching, "don't do anything drastic just yet a while. Let me talk with Jamie. You don't mind if I tell him?"
"I wish you would, auntie. I didn't think I could face him myself."
He still sat on the bench, bony shoulders slumped. Rollo lay on the ground at his feet, the big wolf head resting on Ian's moccasined foot. Moved with pity, I put my arms round Ian, and he leaned his head against me, simply, like a child.
"It isn't the end of the world," I said.
The sun was touching the edge of the mountain, and the sky burned red and gold, the light of it falling in blazing bars through the palisades.
"No," he said, but there was no conviction in his voice.
Chapter 83. Decorations. Charlotte, Mecklenburg County, May the 20th, 1775. The one thing Roger had not envisioned about the making of history was the sheer amount of alcohol involved.
He should have, he thought. If there was anything a career in academia had taught him, it was that almost all worthwhile business was conducted in the pub. The public houses, taverns, ordinaries, and pothouses in Charlotte were doing a roaring business, as delegates, spectators, and hangers-on seethed through them. Men of loyalist sentiments collecting in the King's Arms, those of rabidly opposing views in the Blue Boar, with shifting currents of the unallied and undecided eddying to and fro, purling through the Goose and Oyster, Thomas's Ordinary, the Groats, Simons, Buchanan's, Mueller's, and two or three nameless places that barely qualified as shebeens. Jamie visited all of them, and drank in all of them, sharing beer, ale, rum, punch, shandy, cordial, porter, stout, cider, brandy wine, persimmon beer, rhubarb wine, blackberry wine, cherry bounce, perry, merry brew, and scrumpy. Not all of them were alcoholic, but the great majority were. Roger confined himself largely to beer, and found himself glad of his restraint when he happened to meet with Davy Caldwell in the street, turning from a fruiterer's stall with a handful of early apricots.
"Mr. Mackenzie," Caldwell cried, his face lighting with welcome. "I had nae thought to meet you here, but what blessing that I have."
"Blessing indeed," Roger said, shaking the minister's hand with cordial fervour.
Caldwell had married him and Brianna, and had examined him at the Presbyterian Academy regarding his own calling some months before.
How do you do, Mr. Caldwell?
Oh, for myself, well enough. But my heart misgives me for the fate of my poor brethren.
Caldwell shook his head in dismay, gesturing at a group of men crowding into Simon's ordinary, laughing and talking.
What is to come of this, I ask you, Mr. Mackenzie? What's to come?
Roger was, for an unbalanced instant, tempted to tell him what was to come of it exactly. As it was, though, he gestured to Jamie, who had been stopped by an acquaintance in the street, to go along without him, and turned away to walk a bit with Caldwell.
"Have you come for the conference, then, Mr. Caldwell?" he asked.
"I have that, Mr. Mackenzie, I have that. Little hope have I that my words will make the slightest difference, but it is my duty to speak as I find, and so I shall."
What David Caldwell found was a shocking condition of human slothfulness, for which he blamed the entire current situation. Convinced that unreflective apathy and a stupid concern with personal comfort on the part of the colonists both tempted and provoked the exercise of tyrannical powers on the part of Crown and Parliament.
"It's a point, sure," Roger said, aware that Caldwell's impassioned gestures were attracting a certain amount of notice, even amongst the crowds in the street, most of them reasonably argumentative themselves.
"A point?" Caldwell cried. "Aye, it is. And the point entirely. The ignorance, disregard of moral obligation, and the supreme love of ease of the grovelling sluggards corresponds exactly, exactly, with a tyrant's appetite and cynicism."
He glowered at one gentleman who had subsided against the side of a house, taking a brief respite from the noonday heat, with his hat over his face.
"The Spirit of God must redeem the slothful, fill the human frame with activity, poise, and libertarian consciousness."
Roger wondered, rather, whether Caldwell would view the escalating war as a result of God's intervention, but upon reflection thought that he likely would. Caldwell was a thinker, but a staunch Presbyterian, and thus a believer in predestination.
"The slothful encourage and facilitate oppression," Caldwell explained, with a scornful gesture toward a family of tinkers enjoying an al fresco luncheon in the yard of a house. "Their own shame and sinking spirits, their own pitiful compliance and submission, these become self-made chains of slavery."
"Oh, aye," Roger said, and coughed. Caldwell was a famous preacher, and rather inclined to want to keep in practice.
"Will you take a whet, Mr. Caldwell?"
It was a warm day, and Caldwell's rather round cherubic face was becoming very red. They went into Thomas's ordinary, a fairly respectable house, and sat down with tankards of the house beer, for Caldwell, like most, didn't regard beer as being in any way drink, like rum or whiskey.
What else, after all, would one drink? Milk?
Out of the sun, and with a cooling draught to hand, David Caldwell became less heated in his expressions, as well as his countenance.
"Praise God for the fortune of meeting you here, Mr. Mackenzie," he said, breathing deep after lowering his tankard. "I had sent a letter, but doubtless you will have left home before it could come. I wish to inform you of the gladsome news. There is to be a Presbytery session."
Roger felt a sudden leap of the heart.
"When? And where?" "Edenton, early next month. The Reverend Dr. McCorkle is coming from Philadelphia. He'll remain for a time before departing on his further journey. He is going to the Indies to encourage the efforts of the church there. I am, of course, presuming to know your mind. I apologize for the forwardness of my address, Mr. Mackenzie. But is it still your desire to seek ordination?"
"With all my heart."
Caldwell beamed and grasped him strongly by the hand.
"Give ye joy of it, dear man. Great joy."
He then plunged into a close description of McCorkle, whom he had met in Scotland, and speculations regarding the state of religion in the colony. He spoke of Methodism with some respect, but considered the New Light Baptists somewhat unregulated in their effusions of worship, though doubtless well-meaning. And surely sincere belief was an improvement over unbelief, whatever the form it might take. In due course, though, he came back round to their present circumstances.
"You've come with your father-in-law, have you?" he asked. "I thought I saw him in the road."
"I have."
"And you did," Roger assured him, fumbling in his pocket for a coin. The pocket itself was full of coiled horsehair. With his academic experience as guide, he had made provision against possible boredom by bringing the makings of a new fishing line.
"Ah."
Caldwell looked at him keenly.
"I've heard things of late. Is it true he's turned Whig?"
"He is a firm friend to liberty," Roger said, cautious, and took breath.
"As am I."
He'd not had occasion to say it out loud before. It gave him a small, breathless feeling just under the breastbone.
"Aha! Aha! Very good. I had heard of it, as I say. And yet there are a great many who say otherwise, that he is a Tory, a loyalist like his relations, and that this protestation of support for the independency movement is but a ruse."
It wasn't phrased as a question, but Caldwell's bushy eyebrow, cocked like a swell's hat, made it clear that it was.
"Jamie Fraser is an honest man," Roger said, and drained his tankard. "And an honourable one," he added, setting it down. "And speaking of the same, I think I must go and find him."
Caldwell glanced around. There was an air of restlessness around them, of men calling their accounts and settling up. The official meeting of the convention was to begin at 2 o'clock, at McIntyre's farmhouse. It was past noon now. Delegates, speakers, and spectators would be slowly gathering, girding themselves for an afternoon of conflict and decision. The breathless feeling came back.
"Aye, then, give him my regards, if you will, though perhaps I may see him myself. And may the Holy Spirit penetrate the incrustations of habit and lethargy, and convert the souls, and rouse the consciences of those who gather here today."
"Amen,"
said Roger, smiling in spite of the glances from the men, and not a few women, around them. He found Jamie in the Blue Boar, in the company of a number of men in whom the Holy Spirit had already been hard at work on the encrustations, judging from the volume. The chatter near the door died away, though, as he made his way through the room, not in cause of his own presence, but because there was something more interesting going on near the centre. To wit, Jamie Fraser and Neil Forbes, both red with heat, passion, and a gallon or two of mixed spirits, head to head over a table and hissing like snakes in the Gaelic. Only a few of the spectators were Gaelic speakers. These were hastily translating the high points of the dialogue for the rest of the crowd. Gaelic insult was an art, and one at which his father-in-law excelled, though Roger was obliged to admit that the lawyer was no slouch at it himself. The translations rendered by the onlookers fell far short of the original. Nonetheless, the tap room was rapt, with occasional admiring whistles or whoops from the spectators, or laughter, as a particularly pungent point was made. Having missed the beginning, Roger had no idea how the conflict had begun. But so far into it as they were, the exchange was focused on cowardice and arrogance. Jamie's remarks aimed at Forbes's leading the attack on Fogarty Sims as a low-minded and cowardly attempt to make himself look the big man at the price of a defenceless man's life. Forbes, shifting into English here, as he realized that they had become the cynosure of the room, taking the view that Jamie's presence here was an unwarrantable affront to those who truly held the ideas of liberty and justice, as everyone knew he was in truth the king's man, but he, the puffed-up cock o' the walk, thought he could pull the wool over everyone's eyes long enough to betray the whole boiling. But if he, Fraser, thought he, Forbes, was fool enough to be gulled by antic tricks in the public street, and a lot of talk with nay more substance than the shrieking of gulls, he, Fraser, had best think again. Jamie slapped a hand flat on the table, making it boom like a drum, and rattling the cups. He rose, glaring down at Forbes.
"Do you libel my honour, sir?"
he cried, also shifting to English.
"For if you do, let us go out, and we shall settle the matter at once, yea or nay."
Sweat was streaming down Forbes's broad, flushed face, and his eyes were gleaming with anger. But even overheated as he was, Roger saw belated caution pluck at his sleeve. Roger hadn't seen the fight in Cross Creek, but Ian had told him the details, meanwhile laughing his head off.
The last thing Neil Forbes could desire was a duel.
"Have ye honour to libel, sir?" Forbes demanded, standing in turn and drawing himself up as though about to address the jury. "Ye come here acting the great one, carousing and showing away like a sailor come ashore with prize money in his pocket. But have we any evidence that your words are more than puffery? Puffery, I say, sir!"
Jamie stood, both hands braced on the tabletop, surveying Forbes through narrowed eyes. Roger had once seen that expression focused on himself. It had been followed rapidly by the sort of mayhem customary in a Glasgow pub on Saturday night. Only more so. The only thing to be thankful for was that Forbes had clearly not heard any whiff of Morva Christie's accusation, or there would be blood on the floor already. Jamie straightened slowly, and his left hand went toward his waist. There were gasps, and Forbes paled. But Jamie had reached for his sporran, not his dirk, and plunged his hand inside.
"As to that, sir," he said,
in a low, even voice that carried through the room,
"I have made myself clear. I am for liberty, and to that end I pledge my name, my fortune."
Here he withdrew his hand from his sporran and slammed it on the table. A small purse, 2 golden guineas, and a jewel.
"And my sacred honour."
The room was silent, all eyes focused on the black diamond which shimmered with a baleful light. Jamie paused for the space of 3 heartbeats, then drew breath.
"Is there any man here who gives me the lie?" he said.
It was ostensibly addressed to the room at large, but his eyes were fixed on Forbes. The lawyer had gone a mottled red and grey, like a bad oyster, but said nothing. Jamie paused again, looked once round the room, then picked up purse, money, and jewel, and stalked out the door. Outside, the town clock chimed 2, the strokes slow and heavy in the humid air. Longnon, Intelligencer. Upon the 20th of this month, a congress met in Charlotte, composed of delegates from Mecklenburg County, for the purpose of discussion upon the issue of current relations with Great Britain. After due deliberation, a declaration was proposed and accepted, whose provisions are herewith shown. 1. That whosoever directly or indirectly abetted, or in any way form or manner countenance to uncharted and dangerous invasion of our rights as claimed by Great Britain, is an enemy to this county, to America, and to the inherent and inalienable rights of man. 2. We, the citizens of Mecklenburg County, do hereby dissolve the political bands which have connected us to the mother country, and hereby absolve ourselves from all allegiance to the British Crown, and abjure all political connection, contract, or association with that nation, who have wantonly trampled on our rights and liberties, and inhumanely shed the innocent blood of American patriots at Lexington. 3. We do hereby declare ourselves a free and independent people, are, and of right, ought to be a sovereign and self-governing association under the control of no power other than that of our God and the general government of the Congress, to the maintenance of which independence, civil and religious, we solemnly pledge to each other our mutual cooperation, our lives, our fortunes, and our most sacred honour. 4. As we now acknowledge the existence and control of no law or legal officers, civil or military, within this county, we do hereby ordain and adopt as a rule of life all, each, and every of our former laws, wherein, nevertheless, the Crown of Great Britain never can be considered as holding rights, privileges, immunities, or authority therein. 5. It is also further decreed that all, each and every military officer in this county is hereby reinstated in his former command and authority, he acting conformably to these regulations, and that every member present of this delegation shall henceforth be a civil officer, namely, a justice of the peace in the character of a committee man, to issue process, hear,
and determine all manners of controversy according to said adopted laws, to preserve peace, union, and harmony in said county, and to use every exertion to spread the love of country and fire of freedom throughout America until a more general and organized government be established in this province. A selection from the members present shall constitute a committee of public safety for said county. 6. That a copy of these resolutions be transmitted by express to the President of the Continental Congress assembled in Philadelphia, to be laid before that body.
Chapter 84. Among the Lettuces. Some idiot or child had left the gate of my garden open. I hurried up the path, hoping that it hadn't been that way for long. If it had been open overnight, the deer would have eaten every lettuce, onion, and bulb plant in the plot, to say nothing of ruining the... I jerked, letting out a small cry. Something like a red-hot hatpin had stabbed me in the neck, and I smacked the place by reflex. An electric jab in the temple made my vision go white, then blur with water, and a fiery stab in the crook of my elbow... Bees! I blundered off the path, suddenly aware that the air was full of them, frenzied and stinging. I plunged through the brush, barely able to see for the watering of my eyes, aware, too late, of the low-pitched thrum of a hive at war. Bear! God damn it, a bear had got in. In the half-second between the first sting and the next, I had glimpsed one of the bee gums lying on its side in the dirt just inside the gate, combs and honey spilling out of it like entrails. I ducked under branches and flung myself into a patch of pokeweed, gasping and cursing incoherently. The sting on my neck throbbed viciously, and the one on my temple was already puffing up, pulling at the eyelid on that side. I felt something crawling on my ankle and batted it away by reflex before it could sting. I wiped tears away, blinking. A few bees sailed past, through the yellow-flowered stems above me, aggressive as spitfires. I crawled a little further, trying at once to get away, slap at my hair, and shake out my skirts, lest any more of them be trapped in my clothes. I was breathing like a steam engine, shaking with adrenaline and fury. Bloody hell, frigging bear, God damn it! My strong impulse was to rush in screaming and slapping my skirts in hopes of panicking the bear. An equally strong impulse of self-preservation overcame it. I scrambled to my feet, and keeping low in case of enraged bees, thrust my way through the brush uphill, meaning to circle the garden and come down on the other side, away from the ravaged hives. I could get back to the path that way, and down to the house, where I could recruit help, preferably armed, to drive away the monster before it destroyed the rest of the hives. No point in keeping quiet, and I crashed through bushes and stumbled over logs, panting with rage. I tried to see the bear, but the growth of grapevines over the palisades was too thick to show me anything but rustling leaves and sun shadows. The side of my face felt as though it were on fire, and jolts of pain shot through the trigeminal nerve with each heartbeat, making the muscles twitch and the eye water terribly. I reached the path just below the spot where the first bee had stung me. My gardening basket lay where I'd dropped it, tools spilled out. I grabbed the knife I used for everything, from pruning to digging roots. It was a stout thing with a 6-inch blade, and while it mightn't impress the bear, I felt better for having it. I glanced at the open gate, ready to run, but saw nothing. The ruined hive lay just as I'd seen it. The wax combs broken and squashed, the smell of honey thick in the air. But the combs were not scattered. Shattered pillars of wax still stuck to the exposed wooden base of the hive. A bee zoomed menacingly past my ear, and I ducked, but didn't run. It was quiet. I tried to stop panting, trying to hear over the thunder of my own racing pulse. Bears weren't quiet. They didn't need to be. I should hear snufflings and gulping noises, at least. Rustlings of broken foliage, the lap of a long tongue. I didn't. Cautiously, I moved sideways up the path, a step at a time, ready to run. There was a good-sized oak about 20 feet away. Could I make that if the bear popped out? I listened as hard as I could, but heard nothing beyond the soft rustle of the grapevines and the sound of angry bees, now dropped to a whining hum as they gathered thick on the remnants of their combs. It was gone. Had to be. Still wary, I edged closer, knife in hand. I smelled the blood and saw her in the same instant. She was lying in the salad bed, her skirt flown out like some gigantic rusty flower blooming amid the young lettuces. I was kneeling by her, with no memory of reaching her, and the flesh of her arm was warm when I grasped her wrist. Such small, fragile bones. But slack. There was no pulse. "Of course not," said the cold, small watcher inside. "Her throat is cut. There's blood everywhere, but you can see the artery isn't pumping. She's dead." Malva's grey eyes were open, blank with surprise, and her cap had fallen off. I clutched her wrist harder, as though I must be able to find the buried pulse, to find some trace of life. And did. The bulge of her belly moved very slightly, and I dropped the flaccid arm at once and seized my knife, scrabbling for the hem of her skirt. I acted without thought, without fear, without doubt. There wasn't anything but the knife and the pressure, the flesh parting, and the faint possibility, the panic of absolute need. I slit the belly from navel to pubis, pushing hard through slack muscle, nicked the womb, but no matter, cut quick but careful through the wall of the womb, dropped the knife, and thrust my hands into the depths of Malva Christie, still blood warm, and seized the child, cupping, turning, wrenching hard in my frenzy to pull it free, bring it out from sure death, bring it into the air, help it breathe. Her body flopped and heaved as I jerked, limp limbs flailing with the force of my yanking. It came free with the suddenness of birth, and I was swiping blood and mucus from the tiny sealed face, blowing into its lungs, gently, gently. You have to blow gently. The alveoli of the lungs are like cobwebs, so small, compressing its chest no more than a handspan, two fingers pressing, no more, and felt the tiny spring of it, delicate as a watch spring, felt the movement, small squirms, a faint instinctive struggling, and felt it fade, that flicker, that tiny spark of life, cried out in anguish and clutched the tiny doll-like body to my breast, still warm, still warm. "Don't go," I said. "Don't go, don't go, please don't go." But the vibrancy faded, a small blue glow that seemed to light the palms of my hands for an instant, then dwindle like a candle flame to the coal of a smouldering wick, to the faintest trace of brightness. Then everything was dark. I was still sitting in the brilliant sun, crying and blood-soaked, the body of the little boy in my lap, the butchered corpse of my Malva beside me, when they found me. Chapter 85. The Stolen Bride. A week passed after Malva's death, and there was no slightest hint of who had killed her. Whispering, sidelong glances, and a palpable fog of suspicion hung about the ridge. But despite Jamie's every effort, no one could be located who knew or would say anything at all useful. I could see the tension and frustration building up in Jamie day by day, and knew it must find an outlet. I had no idea what he might do, though. After breakfast on the Wednesday, Jamie stood glowering at the window in his study, then slammed down his fist on the table with a suddenness that made me jump. "I have reached the mortal limit of endurance," he informed me. "One moment more of this and I shall run mad. I must do something, and I will." Without waiting for any response to this statement, he strode to the office door, flung it open, and bellowed,
Joseph!
Into the hall. Mr. Weems appeared out of the kitchen, where he had been sweeping the chimney at Mrs. Bugg's direction, looking startled, pale, soot-smudged, and generally unkempt. Jamie ignored the black footprints on the study floor. He had burned the rug, and fixed Mr. Weems with a commanding gaze.
"Do you want that woman?" he demanded.
"Woman?" Mr. Weems was understandably bewildered. "What? Oh, are you... might you be referring to Fräulein Berish?"
"Who else? Do you want her?"
Jamie repeated. It had plainly been a long time since anyone had asked Mr. Weems what he wanted, and it took him some time to gather his wits from the shock of it. Brutal prodding by Jamie forced him past deprecating murmurs about the Fräulein's friends, no doubt being the best judge of her happiness, his own unsuitability, poverty, and general unworthiness as a husband, and into, at long last, a reckless admission that, well, if the Fräulein should not be terribly averse to the prospect, perhaps, well, in a word... "Aye, sir," he said, looking terrified at his own boldness. "I do, very much," he blurted.
"Good," Jamie nodded, pleased. "We'll go and get her, then."
Mr. Weems was open-mouthed with astonishment. So was I. Jamie swung round to me, issuing orders with the confidence and joie de vivre of a sea captain with a fat prize in view.
"Go and find young Ian for me, will you, Sassenach? And tell Mrs. Bugg to put up food, enough for a week's travel for four men. And then fetch Roger Mack. We'll need a minister."
He rubbed his hands together in satisfaction, then clapped Mr. Weems on the shoulder, causing a small puff of soot to rise from his clothes.
"Go fettle yourself, Joseph," he said, "and comb your hair. We're going to go and steal you a bride." "And put a pistol to his breast,"
young Ian chanted.
Marry me, minister, or else I'll be your priest, or else I'll be your priest."
"Of course," he said, dropping the song in which a bald young man named Willie rides with his friends to abduct and forcibly marry a young woman who proves bolder yet. "We'll hope you prove a wee bit more capable than Willie upon the night, aye, Joseph?" Mr. Weems, scrubbed, dressed, and fairly vibrating with excitement, gave him a glance of complete incomprehension. Roger grinned, tightening the strap of his saddlebag.
"Young Willie obliges a minister to marry him to the young woman at gunpoint," he explained to Mr. Weems. "But then, when he takes his stolen bride to bed, she'll have none of him, and his best efforts will not avail to force her." "And so return me, Willie, to my home, as virgin as I came, as virgin as I came,"
Ian carolled. "Now, mind," Roger said warningly to Jamie, who was heaving his own saddlebags over Gideon's back.
"If the Fräulein is at all unwilling..." "What, unwilling to be wed to Joseph?"
Jamie clapped Mr. Weems on the back, then bent to give him a foot up and fairly heaved the smaller man into the saddle.
"I canna see any woman of sense turning from such an opportunity, can you, Harwich?"
He took a quick look round the clearing to see all was well, then ran up the steps and kissed me in quick farewell, before running down again to Mount Gideon, who for once seemed amenable and made no effort to bite him.
"Keep well, Munion Down," he said, smiling into my eyes.
And then they were gone, thundering out of the clearing like a gang of Highland raiders, Ian's ear-splitting whoops ringing from the trees. Oddly enough, the departure of the men seemed to ease things slightly. The talk, of course, went merrily on, but without Jamie or Ian there to serve as a lightning rod, it merely crackled to and fro like St. Elmo's fire, spitting, fizzing, and making everyone's hair stand on end, but essentially a harmless phenomenon unless touched directly. The house felt less an embattled fortress and more the eye of a storm. Also, with Mr. Weems out of the house, Lizzie came to visit, bringing little Rodney Joseph, as the baby was called.
Roger, having set his face firmly against the young father's enthusiastic suggestions of Tiglath Pileser and Ichabod. We Rogerina had come out of it all right, being now commonly known as Rory. But Roger declined entirely to hear of a child being christened anything that might result in his being known to the world at large as Icky. Rodney seemed a very congenial child, in part because he had never quite lost that air of round-eyed astonishment that made him seem agog to hear what you had to say. Lizzie's astonishment at his birth had mutated into an enchantment that might have completely eclipsed Joe and Kezzy, were it not for the fact that they shared it. Either one of them would, unless forcibly stopped, spend half an hour discussing Rodney's bowel habits with the intensity heretofore reserved for new snares and the peculiar things found inside the stomachs of animals they had killed. Pigs, it seemed, really would eat anything. So would Rodney. A few days after the men's departure on their bride-stealing expedition, Brianna had come up from her cabin with Jemmy to visit, and Lizzie likewise had brought Rodney. The two of them joined Amy McCullum and me in the kitchen, where we were spending a pleasant evening sewing by the light of the fire, admiring Rodney, keeping a negligent eye on Jemmy and Aidan, and, after a certain amount of cautious exploration, devoting ourselves wholeheartedly to a rundown of the male population of the Ridge, viewed in the light of suspects. I, of course, had a more personal and painful interest in the topic, but all three of the young women were solidly on the side of justice. That is, the side that refused even to contemplate the notion that either Jamie or I might have had anything to do with the murder of Mulver Christie. For myself, I found such open speculation rather a comfort. I had, of course, been engaging in private conjecture non-stop, and an exhausting business it was, too. Not only was it unpleasant to visualize every man I knew in the role of cold-blooded murderer, the process obliged me continuously to reimagine the murder itself and relive the moment when I had found her. "I'd really hate to think it might have been Bobby," Bree said, frowning as she pushed a wooden darning egg into the heel of a sock. "He seems just such a nice boy." Lizzie drew down her chin at this, pursing her lips. "Oh, aye, he's a sweet lad," she said, "but what you might call warm-blooded." All of us looked at her. "Well," she said mildly, "I didn't let him, but he tried hard enough. And when I said no, he did go off and kick a tree." "My husband would do that sometimes if I refused him," Amy said, thoughtful. "But I'm sure he wouldn't have cut my throat." "Well, but Malva didn't refuse whoever it was," Bree pointed out, squinting as she threaded her darning needle. "That was the problem. He killed her because she was pregnant, and he was afraid she'd tell everyone." "Ho," Lizzie said, triumphant. "Well, then, it can't have been Bobby at all, can it? For when my da turned him awa..." A brief shadow crossed her face at mention of her father, who still had not spoken a word to her, nor acknowledged the birth of little Rodney. "Did he not think of spearing for Mulver Christie? Ian said he meant to. And if she was with child by him, well then, her father would be obliged to agree, would he not?" Amy nodded, finding this convincing, but Bree had objections. "Yes, but she was insisting that it wasn't his baby. And he threw up in the blackberry bushes when he heard that she was..." Her lips compressed momentarily. "Well, he wasn't happy at all. So he might have killed her out of jealousy, don't you think?" Lizzie and Amy hummed dubiously at this. Both of them were fond of Bobby, but well obliged to admit the possibility. "What I wonder about," I said, a little hesitantly, "is the older men, the married ones. Everyone knows about the young men who were interested in her, but I've certainly seen more than one married man glance at her in passing." "I nominate Hiram Crombie," Bree said at once, stabbing her needle into the heel of the sock. Everyone laughed, but she shook her head. "No, I'm serious. It's always the really religious, very uptight ones that turn out to have secret drawers full of women's underwear and slink around molesting choir boys."
Amy's jaw dropped.
"Drawers? Full of women's underwear," she said. "What? Shifts and stays? Whatever would he do with them?"
Brianna flushed at that, having forgotten her audience. She coughed, but there was no good way out.
Well, I was thinking more of French women's underwear," she said weakly. "Lacy sorts of things."
"Oh, French," Lizzie said, nodding wisely. Everyone knew about the notorious reputation of French ladies, though I doubted that any woman on Fraser's Ridge, save myself, had ever seen one. In the interests of covering Bree's lapse, though, I obligingly told them about La Nestle, the King of France's mistress, who had had her nipples pierced, and appeared at court with her breasts exposed, sporting gold hoops through them. "Another few months of this," Lizzie said darkly, looking down at Rodney, who was nursing fiercely at her breast, tiny fists clenched with effort, "and I shall be able to do the same. I'll tell Joe and Kezzy to fetch me back some hoops when they sell their hides, aye?" In the midst of the laughter at this, the sound of a knock at the front door passed unnoticed. Or would have, if not for Jemmy and Aidan, who had been playing in Jamie's study, rushing into the kitchen to tell us about it. "I'll get it." Bree set down her darning, but I was already on my feet. "No, I'll go." I waved her back, picked up a candlestick, and went down the dark hallway, heart beating fast. Visitors after dark were almost always an emergency of one kind or another. So was this one, though not any kind I might have expected. For a moment, I didn't even recognize the tall woman who stood swaying on the stoop, white-faced and gaunt. Then she whispered, "Frau Fraser, may I come?" And fell into my arms. The noise of it brought all the young women rushing to help, and we had Monica Berish, for it was indeed Mr. Weems's putative bride, laid on the settle, covered with quilts, and plied with hot toddy in nothing flat. She recovered quickly. There was nothing wrong with her, really, save exhaustion and hunger. She said she hadn't eaten in 3 days. And within a short time was able to sit up eating soup and explain her astonishing presence. "It was my cousin's wife," she said, closing her eyes in momentary bliss at the aroma of split-pea soup with ham. "She did not want me ever, and when her husband had the bad accident and lost his wagon, so there was not so much money to keep us all, she did not want me more. She had, she said, yearned for Joseph, but hadn't had either the strength nor yet the means to withstand her family's opposition and insist upon returning to him." "Oh?" Lizzie was examining her in a close but not unfriendly manner. "What happened then?" Fräulein Berish turned large, gentle eyes on her. "I could not bear it more," she said simply. "I wish so much to be with Joseph. My cousin's wife, she wished me to be gone, so she will give a small bit of money. So I came," she concluded with a shrug, and took another small, greedy spoonful of soup. "You walked?" Brianna said. "From Halifax?" Fräulein Berish nodded, licking the spoon, and put out a foot from under the quilts. Her shoes had worn entirely through at the sole. She had wrapped them with random scraps of leather and strips of fabric torn from her shift, so her feet looked like bundles of filthy rags. "Elizabeth," she said, looking earnestly at Lizzie, "I hope you do not mind I come. Your father, he is here? I hope so much he does not mind too." No, I said, exchanging a glance with Lizzie. "He isn't here, but I'm sure that he'll be delighted to see you."
"Oh?"
Her gaunt face, which had shown alarm at hearing that Mr. Weems wasn't here, grew radiant when we told her where he was.
"Oh," she breathed, clasping the spoon to her bosom as though it were Mr. Weems's head. "Oh, mein Kavalier!"
Beaming with joy, she looked round at all of us, and for the first time noticed Rodney snoozing in his basket at Lizzie's feet.
"But who is this?" she cried,
and leaned forward to look at him. Not quite asleep, Rodney opened round dark eyes and regarded her with a solemn, sleepy interest.
"This is my wee Bernie. Rodney Joseph, he's called. For my da, ken?"
Lizzie hoisted him out of his basket, chubby knees pulled up under his chin, and laid him gently in Monica's arms. She cooed over him in German, face alight. "Granny last," Bree muttered to me out of the side of her mouth, and I felt laughter bubble up under my stays. I hadn't laughed since before Mulva's death, and found it balm to the spirit. Lizzie was explaining earnestly to Monica the estrangement resulting from her unorthodox marriage, to which Monica was nodding, clicking her tongue in sympathetic understanding, and I did wonder how much of it she grasped, and talking baby talk to Rodney all at once. "That chance of Mr. Weems staying estranged," I said, out of the side of my own mouth. "Keep his new wife from her new grandson. Ha!"
"Yes. What's a little matter of dual sons-in-law?" Bree agreed.
Amy was regarding the tender scene with a slight sense of wistfulness. She reached out and put an arm round Aidan's skinny shoulders.
"Well, they do say the more the merrier," she said.
Chapter 86. Priorities. 3 shirts, an extra pair of decent breeches, 2 pair of stockings, 1 lisle, 1 silk. Wait, where were the silk ones? Brianna stepped to the door and called to her husband, who was industriously laying segments of clay pipe into the trench he had dug, assisted by Jemmy and Aidan. "Roger, what have you done with your silk stockings?" He paused, frowning, and rubbed his head. Then, handing the shovel to Aidan, he came across to the house, leaping over the open trench.
"I wore them last Sunday to breach, no?" he asked, reaching her. "What did I—" "Oh."
"Oh," she said suspiciously, seeing his face change from puzzlement to guilt.
"What's—" "Oh. Ah. Well, you'd stayed to whom with Jem and his stomachache?"
A tactically helpful ailment, greatly exaggerated, in order to keep her from having to sit through 2 hours of staring and whispering.
"So when Jockey Abernathy asked me would I care to go fishing with him?"
"Roger Mackenzie," she said, fixing him with a look of wrath, "if you put your good silk stockings in a creel full of smelly fish and forgot them—"
"I'll just nip up to the house and borrow a pair from your da, shall I?" he said hurriedly. "I'm sure mine will turn up somewhere."
"So will your head," she said. "Probably under a rock."
That made him laugh, which wasn't what she had intended, but which had the effect of easing her temper.
"I'm sorry," he said,
leaning forward to kiss her forehead.
"It's probably Freudian."
"Oh?
And what does leaving your stockings wrapped around a dead trout symbolize?" she demanded.
"Generalized guilt and divided loyalties, I imagine," he said,
still joking, but not so much.
"Bree, I've been thinking. I really don't think I should go. I don't need to."
"Yes, you do,"
she said, as firmly as possible.
"Da says so, Mama says so, and so do I."
"Oh, well then."
He smiled, but she could see the uneasiness under his humour, the more so because she shared it. Mulva Christie's murder had caused an uproar on the ridge, alarm, hysteria, suspicion, and finger-pointing in every direction. Several young men, Bobby Higgins among them, had simply disappeared from the ridge, whether from a sense of guilt or merely from a sense of self-preservation. There had been accusations enough to go around. Even she herself had come in for her share of gossip and suspicion, some of her unguarded remarks about Mulva Christie having been repeated. But by far the greatest weight of suspicion rested squarely on her parents.
Both of them were doing their best to go about their daily business, grimly ignoring the gossip and the pointed looks. But it was getting harder. Anyone could see that. Roger had gone at once to visit the Christies, had gone every day since Malva's death, save for his hasty expedition to Halifax, had buried the girl with simplicity and tears, and had since worn himself out with being reasonable and soothing and firm to everyone else on the ridge. He had immediately put aside his plan to go to Edenton for ordination, but Jamie, hearing of it, had insisted. "You've done everything here you could possibly do," Brianna said for the 100th time. "There's nothing else you can do to help, and it might be years before you have another chance." She knew how urgently he wished to be ordained, and would have done anything to further that wish. For herself, she wished that she could see it. But without a great deal of talk, they had agreed that it was best for her and Jem to go to River Run, and wait there for Roger to make the trip to Edenton, and then return. It couldn't do a candidate for ordination any good to turn up with a Catholic wife and child. The guilt of leaving, though, with her parents standing in the eye of the whirlwind. "You have to go," she repeated. "But maybe I..."
He stopped her with a look. "No, we've done that."
His argument was that her presence couldn't affect public opinion, which was probably true. She realized that his real reason, shared by her parents, was a desire to get her and Jem away from the situation on the ridge, out of the uproar and safe, preferably before Jem realized that a good many of the neighbors thought that one, if not both, of his grandparents was a cold-blooded murderer. And to her private shame, she was eager to go. Someone had killed Malva and her baby. Every time she thought of it, the possibilities swam before her, the litany of names. And every time she was forced to see her cousin's name among them. Ian hadn't run away. And she couldn't, could not think that it had been him. And yet every day she was obliged to see Ian and to contemplate the possibility. She stood staring into the bag she was packing, folding and refolding the shirt in her hands, looking for reasons to go, reasons to stay, and knowing that no reason had any power at all. Not now. A dull thunk from outside jerked her from her mire of indecision. What? She reached the door in two steps, fast enough to see Jem and Aidan disappearing into the woods like a pair of rabbits. On the edge of the trench lay the cracked pieces of the pipe segment they had just dropped. "You little snot rags," she bellowed, and grabbed for a broom, intending what she didn't know. But violence seemed the only outlet for the frustration that had just erupted like a volcano, searing through her. "Bree," Roger said softly, and put a hand on her back. "It's not important." She jerked away and rounded on him, the blood roaring in her ears. "Do you have any idea how long it takes to make one of those? How many firings it takes to get one that's not cracked? How..."
"Yes, I do know," he said, his voice level. "And it's still not important."
She stood trembling, breathing hard. Very gently, he reached out and took the broom from her, standing it neatly back in its place.
"I need to go," she said, when she could form words again.
And he nodded, his eyes tinged with the sadness he had carried ever since the day of Malva's death.
"Aye, you do," he said quietly.
He came behind her, put his arms around her, his chin resting on her shoulder, and gradually she stopped shaking. Across the clearing she saw Mrs. Bugg come down the path from the garden with an apron full of cabbages and carrots. Claire hadn't set foot in her garden since... "Will they be all right?"
"We'll pray that they will," he said,
and tightened his arms around her. She was comforted by his touch, and didn't notice until later that he had not, in fact,
reassured her that they would. Chapter 87.
Justice is mine, saith the Lord.
I poked at the last package from Lord John, trying to work up enough enthusiasm to open it. It was a small wooden crate, perhaps more vitriol. I supposed I should make a fresh batch of ether, but then what was the point? People had stopped coming to my surgery, even for the treatment of minor cuts and bruises, let alone the odd appendectomy. I ran a finger through the dust on the counter and thought that I should at least take care of that. Mrs. Bug kept the rest of the house spotless, but wouldn't come into the surgery. I added dusting to the long list of things that I should do, but made no move to go and find a dustcloth. Sighing, I got up and went across the hall. Jamie was sitting at his desk, twiddling a quill and staring at a half-finished letter. He put down the quill when he saw me, smiling.
"How is it, Sassenach?"
"All right," I said, and he nodded, accepting it at face value. His face showed the lines of strain, and I knew that he was no more all right than I was. "I haven't seen Ian all day. Did he say he was going?" "To the Cherokee, I meant. Little wonder if he wanted to get away from the ridge. I thought it had taken a good deal of fortitude for him to stay as long as he had, bearing the stares and murmurs and the outright accusations." Jamie nodded again and dropped the quill back into its jar.
"Aye, I told him to go. No purpose to him staying any longer. There'd only be more fights."
Ian didn't say anything about the fights, but had more than once turned up to supper with the marks of battle on him. "Right. Well, I'd better tell Mrs. Bug before she starts the supper." Still, I made no motion to get up, finding some small sense of comfort in Jamie's presence, some surcease from the constant memory of the small bloody weight in my lap, inert as a lump of meat, and the sight of Mulver's eyes, so surprised. I heard horses in the yard, several of them. I glanced at Jamie, who shook his head, brows raised, then rose to go and meet the visitors, whoever they were. I followed him down the hall, wiping my hands on my apron, and mentally revisiting the supper menu to accommodate what sounded like at least a dozen guests, from the whickering and murmuring I heard in the dooryard. Jamie opened the door and stopped dead. I looked over his shoulder and felt terror seize me. Horsemen, black against the sinking sun, and in that moment I was back in the whiskey clearing, damp with sweat and clad in nothing but my shift. Jamie heard my gasp and put back a hand to keep me away.
"What do you want, Brown?" he said,
sounding most unfriendly.
"We've come for your wife," said Richard Brown.
There was an unmistakable note of gloating in his voice, and hearing it, the down hairs on my body rippled with cold, and black spots floated in my field of vision. I stepped back, hardly feeling my feet, and took hold of the door jamb to my surgery, clinging to it for support.
"Well, you can just be on your way, then," Jamie replied,
with the same unfriendly tone.
"You've nothing to do with my wife, nor she with you."
"Ah, now, there you're wrong, Mr. Fraser."
My vision had cleared, and I saw him urge his horse up closer to the stoop. He leaned down, peering through the door, and evidently saw me, for he smiled in a most unpleasant fashion.
"We've come to arrest your wife for the dastard crime of murder."
Jamie's hand tensed where he gripped the door, and he drew himself slowly to his fullest height, seeming to expand as he did so.
"You'll leave my land, sir," he said,
and his voice had dropped to a level just above the rustlings of horses and harness.
"And you'll go now."
I felt rather than heard footsteps behind me, Mrs. Bug coming to see what was afoot. "Bright, save us," she whispered, seeing the men. Then she was gone, running back through the house, light-footed as a deer. I should follow her, I knew, escape through the back door, run up into the forest, hide. But my limbs were frozen. I could barely breathe, let alone move.
And Richard Brown was looking at me over Jamie's shoulder, open dislike mingling with triumph.
"Oh, we'll leave," he said, straightening up. "Hand her over, and we'll be gone. Vanished like the morning dew," he said, and laughed.
Dimly, I wondered whether he was drunk.
"By what right do you come here?"
Jamie demanded. His left hand rose, rested on the hilt of his dirk in plain threat. The sight of it galvanized me finally, and I stumbled down the hall toward the kitchen where the guns were kept.
"Committee of Safety?"
I caught those words in Brown's voice, raised in threat, and then was through into the kitchen. I grabbed the fowling piece from its hooks above the hearth, and wrenching open the drawer of the sideboard, hastily bundled the three pistols there into the large pockets of my surgical apron, made to hold instruments while I worked. My hands were shaking. I hesitated. The pistols were primed and loaded. Jamie checked them every night. Should I take the shot pouch, the powder horn? No time. I heard Jamie's voice and Richard Brown's shouting now at the front of the house. The sound of the back door opening jerked my head up, and I saw an unfamiliar man pause in the doorway looking round. He saw me and started toward me, grinning, hand out to seize my arm. I lifted a pistol from my apron and shot him, point blank. The grin didn't leave his face, but took on a slightly puzzled air. He blinked once or twice, then put a hand to his side where a reddening spot was beginning to spread on his shirt. He looked at his blood-smeared fingers, and his jaw dropped.
"Well, goddamn," he said. "You shot me."
"I did," I said, breathless.
"And I'll bloody do it again if you don't get out of here."
I dropped the empty pistol onto the floor with a crash and scrabbled one-handed in my apron pocket for another, still holding the fowling piece in a death grip. He didn't wait to see if I meant it, but whirled and crashed into the doorframe, then stumbled through it, leaving a smear of blood on the wood. Wisps of black powder smoke floated in the air, mingling oddly with the scent of roasting fish, and I thought for an instant that I might throw up, but managed, despite my nausea, to set down the fowling piece for a moment and bar the door, my hand shaking so that it took several tries. Sudden sounds from the front of the house drove nerves and everything else from my mind, and I was running down the hall, gun in hand, before I had made a conscious decision to move, the heavy pistols in my apron banging against my thighs. They had dragged Jamie off the porch. I caught a brief glimpse of him in the midst of a surging melee of bodies. They'd stopped shouting. There wasn't any noise at all, save for small grunts and the impact of flesh, the scuffling of myriad feet in the dust. It was deadly earnest, that struggle, and I knew at once that they meant to kill him. I levelled the fowling piece at the edge of the crowd farthest from Jamie and pulled the trigger. The crash of the gun and the startled scream seemed to come together, and the scene before me flew apart, the knot of men dissolving, peppered with birdshot. Jamie had kept hold of his dirk. With a little room around him now, I saw him drive it into one man's side, wrench it back and lash sideways in the same motion, scoring a bloody furrow across the forehead of a man who had fallen back a little. Then I caught a glimpse of metal to one side and by reflex shrieked, "Duck!" an instant before Brown's pistol fired. There was a small thung past my ear, and I realized, in a very calm sort of way, that Brown had fired at me, not Jamie. Jamie had, however, ducked. So had everyone else in the yard, and men were now scrambling to their feet, confused, the impetus of the attack dispersed. Jamie had dived toward the porch. He was up and stumbling toward me, striking viciously with the hilt of his dirk at a man who grabbed at his sleeve, so the man fell back with a cry. We might have rehearsed it a dozen times. He took the steps of the porch in one leap and flung himself into me, carrying us both through the door, then spun on his heel and slammed the door, throwing himself against it and holding it against the frenzied impact of bodies for the instant it took me to drop the fowling piece, seize the bolt, and lift it into place. It fell into its hooks with a thunk. The door vibrated to the blows of fists and shoulders, and the shouting had now started up again, but with a different sound,
No gloating, no taunting. Cursing still, but with a set, malign intent.
Neither of us paused to listen.
"I barred the kitchen door,"
I gasped. And Jamie nodded, diving into my surgery to secure the bolts of the inside shutters there. I heard the crash of breaking glass in the surgery behind me as I ran into his study. The windows there were smaller and not glass, placed high in the wall. I slammed the shutters to and bolted them, then ran back into the suddenly darkened hallway to find the gun. Jamie had it already. He was in the kitchen grabbing things, and as I started toward the kitchen door, he came out of it, hung about with shot pouches, powder horns and the like, fowling piece in his hands, and with a jerk of the head motioned me before him up the stairs. The rooms above were still filled with light. It was like bursting up from underwater, and I gulped the light as though it were air, dazzled and eyes watering as I rushed to bolt the shutters in the box room and Amy McCullum's room.